North Korea, with, quote, fire and fury like the world has never seen. A new war, nuclear war, aimed at annihilating the DPRK with weapons immensely more powerful than those dropped on Japan, is now being openly promoted by elements of the U.S. ruling establishment. Quote, if there's going to be a war to stop Kim Jong-un, it will be over there, said Senator Lindsey Graham in an August 2nd interview. If thousands die, they're going to die over there. They're not going to die here. And he, Trump, has told me that to my face. And that may be provocative, but not really. When you're president of the United States, where does your allegiance lie? To the people of the United States. In other words, it's fine with Graham and Trump if thousands of Koreans, Japanese, and U.S. troops die, so long as the United States itself is not affected. The drive towards war was heightened by the UN Security Council's passage of a U.S.-authored resolution imposing harsh new sanctions on the DPRK's economy. After the U.S. refused a Russian-proposed amendment stating that the aim of the sanctions was not regime change, Russia still bowed to U.S. pressure and voted for the resolution, as did China. Ever since the Korean War, when the United States leveled all of North Korea and killed 4 to 5 million Koreans, a wing of the U.S. ruling class has sought regime change in the DPRK. The war never actually ended. Combat was suspended by an armistice agreement signed in 1953, when the Eisenhower administration told the DPRK leadership that if they didn't sign, the U.S. would destroy all of the population centers of the North with nuclear bombs. The combined military force of Chinese volunteers and North Korean military units and guerrillas evicted the U.S. and allied troops from North Korea and drove them south of the 38th parallel. Thus, the Korean War constituted the first military defeat for U.S. imperialism, followed 20 years later by its defeat in Vietnam. North Korea's militancy and tenacity in its struggle to preserve Korea's national identity in the face of the U.S. imperialist onslaught remains a characteristic feature of the political and psychological orientation of the DPRK. When asked in 2001 what his policy on the DPRK was, a top State Department figure, John Bolton, replied, quote, no North Korea. Echoing Bolton, Graham stated in his recent interview, quote, there is a military option to destroy North Korea's program and North Korea itself. In 2017, annual massive military maneuvers involving hundreds of thousands of South Korean and tens of thousands of U.S. troops, the commanding generals freely spoke of rehearsing for invasion of the North and decapitation of its leadership. But mainstream media, liberal as well as conservative, acts, as always, in times of war danger, as transmitters of Pentagon propaganda. Certain key terms are endlessly repeated. The dictator, the North Korean threat, murderous, and rogue state. Terms that are never applied to U.S. allies, no matter how dictatorial, nor, of course, to the United States itself, no matter how many it kills. The main factor restraining a U.S. military assault on the DPRK up to now has been the North's military capacity to hit back at South Korea and Japan if attacked. Both of the latter countries are home to many U.S. bases. In true colonial fashion, South Korea's military would be under U.S. command in the event of a war. In his 2002 State of the Union message, George W. Bush ludicrously labeled Iran, Iraq, and North Korea as the axis of evil, and the next year invaded Iraq and destroyed that country. That was when North Korea put its nuclear weapons program into high gear. The U.S.-NATO destruction of Libya after it dismantled its nuclear program reinforced the DPRK leadership's determination. It is clear that North Korea's nuclear program is met as a deterrent. The DPRK leaders know without a doubt that if they were to launch a first strike, that they would be annihilated by the far greater nuclear weapons of the U.S. The advance of the DPRK's nuclear weapons and missile programs has caused a deep and intensifying debate inside the imperialist ruling class. One side, represented by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Senator John McCain, and some leading generals, believes that a military attack would be too costly and destabilizing. The other side believes that, as Lindsey Graham put it, war with North Korea is, quote, inevitable, and argues that it should take place sooner rather than later when the DPRK may become militarily stronger. The latter view echoes the Cold War, when powerful factions in both the civilian and military establishment argued, beginning in the late 1940s, for preemptive strikes on the USSR and the People's Republic of China. On several occasions, the world came close to nuclear catastrophe, and the U.S. government has never agreed to pledge to forego first-strike use of nuclear weapons. The DPRK has offered a way out of the current crisis, stating that it would suspend nuclear weapons and long-range missile tests if the U.S. and South Korea cease their massive military maneuvers and the United States signs a peace treaty ending the Korean War. Trump, like Obama before him, has flatly refused. The Party for Socialism and Liberation rejects the demonization employed by imperialism against all targeted countries and governments, which is particularly intense towards the people and state of the DPRK. We stand with the Korean people and all the people in Asia who resolutely oppose any new imperialist aggression against the people of North Korea.
U.S. forces give the nod. It's a setback for your country. Bombs and trenches all in rows. Bombs and threats still ask for more.
You're listening to Back in the USSR. You're on 93.3 FM. That, of course, was Midnight Oil with U.S. Forces. And I realize I'm throwing info at you thick and fast about Korea and the Korean War and the situation right now with North Korea. But doing this is crucial if we want to get beyond the propaganda and see what's really going on. So the following is excerpted from Paul Atwood, a senior lecturer in American Studies at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, who provides a concise summary entitled, quote, entitled The Endless Atrocities, Endless Atrocities, the U.S. role in creating the North Korean fortress state. He gives a concise summary of the history that informs North Korea's relations with the United States and drives its determination never to submit to any American diktat. So during the Korean War, when China warned the U.S. that it would not sit by while its neighbor was invaded. I mean, China itself also feared being invaded by the United States at that time. General Douglas MacArthur shrugged this off, saying that if the Chinese, quote, tried to get down to Pyongyang, he would, quote, slaughter them, adding, we are the best. MacArthur then ordered airstrikes to lay waste thousands of square miles of northern Korea bordering China and ordered infantry divisions ever closer to its border. It was the terrible devastation of this bombing campaign, worse than anything seen during World War II, short of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that to this day dominates North Korea's relations with the United States and drives its determination never to submit to any American diktat. General Curtis LeMay directed this onslaught. It was he who had firebombed Tokyo in March 1945, saying that it was, quote, about time we stopped swatting at flies and gone after the manure pile. It was he who later said that the U.S., quote, ought to bomb North Vietnam back into the Stone Age. Remarking about his desire to lay waste to North Korea, he said, quote, we burned down every town in North Korea and South Korea, too. LeMay was by no means exaggerating. LeMay estimated that the U.S. killed off some 20% of the North Korean population. And for comparison, the highest percentage of population loss in World War II was in Poland, which lost approximately 17% of its people overall. Dean Rusk, who later became a Secretary of State, said the U.S. targeted an attempt to execute every person that moved in North Korea and tried to knock over, quote, every brick standing on top of another. In his work, Professor Carl Boggs gives many examples of mass atrocities. One taking place in 1950 when the U.S. rounded up nearly 1,000 civilians who were then beaten, tortured, and shot to death by U.S. troops. Another in Pyongyang when the U.S. summarily executed 3,000 people, mostly women and children, and another where the U.S. executed some 6,000 civilians, many with machine guns, many by beheading them with sabers. He notes that this list of the major atrocities goes on, quote, goes on endlessly. So we should not be surprised at all that North Korea wants to protect itself from the United States, given the atrocities that the United States has committed against the Korean people, and which unfortunately are largely forgotten today, certainly in the West. You never hear, they're never talked about. And basically, brothers and sisters, we really do need to educate ourselves about the real history of the world and the real history of the American Empire and the real history of what it did to the peoples around the world and the history of people as they fought back against the American Empire and resisted. This is crucial if we don't want to be fooled by what the American Empire tells us now and that we don't get driven into any wars, let alone nuclear wars, by the likes of Donald Trump. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3. I don't want to get left behind.
Be an everyday hero in your community. Parkinson's Super Walk takes place this September. Since 1990, the event has been raising awareness and funds to support Canadians with Parkinson's, their families, and the health professionals that treat them. Participate at one of the many locations across Canada. To register yourself or a team or to volunteer, visit online at www.parkinsonsuperwalk.ca or call Parkinson Canada at 1-800-565-3000. A stranger answers, I hesitate.
Close to Home, an eclectic mix of Canadian music on CFRU 93.3 FM. Thursday mornings at 7 a.m. with your host, Tom Rydell. I'll make it easier for you to get up and greet the day. Close to Home, Thursday mornings, 7 a.m.
Riverfest Elora is taking place August 18th to the 20th and will be a weekend full of wonderful music in Elora's beautiful Bissell Park. CFRU is looking forward to co-presenting two of the Riverfest performances. Saya, performing at 7 p.m. on the Friday, weaves fusionist pop out of hip-hop, jazz, funk, and soul with a seemingly incongruous passion for erotica and Italian horror. And then, at 6:40 p.m. on Sunday, Ketch Sloan. Over the course of 10 albums and more than 30 singles, this band has tackled countless creative conceits from hardcore punk 7 inches to kaleidoscopic song cycles like 2006's 30-track Never Hear the End of It. Come on out to Riverfest from August 18th to the 20th at Bissell Park in Elora for Saya Sloan and countless other musicians. For tickets and more info, visit riverfestelora.com. This event is physically accessible.
You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Flow combat, be I born that, beaches storm that, reformat the masses, I'm redrafting the battle maps at top of task list, I build a classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit, I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back by facts, packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion, burn mics up to ashes, I make fascists, crapped in pantsers, stanzas, cure culture. Trouble cancer, I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum, getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis, my word act like nominally gat, rhymingly packed, punch, crash the fun by metric tons and plus my math, distribute cash among the classes, take from the thieving greedy bastard, get back like church has to get past, collapse structure, fuck facades, I destruct the support beams and bars, wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction, flip the shit just like a brick throne, dethrone kings, bring the trees on, my tone rock like Gibraltar pop, hip hop hotter than a rocket shot, I'm crime, think, fuck, bring the big dog, teach you to flee from the flock, walk off, switch shit, hit my target, drop like bombs in the form of carpets, I got the target locked on that all shit. Pump your fist if you know what we are. That's a rap. Boom bap. Original rap at. Take it back. Boom bap. Boom bap. I'm talking true path, master the craft, the pupil, the prof, keep dropping math. Boom bap, blast the bazooka rap. Boom bap, original rap.
All of humanity can be divided into Group A, B, and C. Group A is made up of those people who live principally off stock dividends, interest payments on their bond investments, royalties on their land and mineral holdings, rents on their properties. That's Group A. Group B and C make up the other 99.5% of humanity, and they live off Group B. The people in Group B live off wages, salaries, fees, commissions, tips, pensions. And Group C is made up of tens of millions of people who don't even get that. They live in utter destitution from hand to mouth, from whatever handouts or whatever charity bits or whatever fragmentary incomes they can scrounge. The thing that the people in Group A and B have in common is that they both live off the labor of the people in Group B. The people in Group A don't just do this. They're very active. They have an active element. We could call them the owning class because they own almost everything in the world. They own most of the land. They own the factories, the industries, the banks, the media. They also own a lot of the state. That is, their representatives, the politically active elements from their ranks, move in and become the secretaries of defense, secretaries of state, CIA directors, and they're the ones who also filter out in the beginning with the very first primary. The primary before the one you get to vote in is called the money primary. And they, with their contributions, they filter out who will be the suitable candidates and who will be the unknowns. And who will be designated at the very beginning the front runners. Now, they take great pains at trying to keep the world this way because they love it that way. I know in the movies you see things about the unhappy rich. Don't believe it for a minute. They love having their private planes and their estates and all their wonderful things and their power and their prestige and their immense wealth. And most of all, they're very concerned about those instruments of organization which accumulate that wealth for them, which are called the giant multinational corporations. Corporations are called producer interests. In fact, they don't produce anything. You tell me what a corporation produces. You tell me what a CEO has ever produced. They are, in fact, organizations for the extraction of surplus value from the workforce. They're organizations that mobilize economic and political power to make the world safe for Group A. They don't do that directly in many cases, but they pick the people, they pay the lobbyists, they pay the campaign fees, they do all that stuff. And the state then comes in, that component of the state, not the entire government, but that special component of the state known as the National Security State, which is made up of the White House, the Defense Department, the State Department, the CIA, military intelligence, the Joint Chief of Staff, FBI, and a few other elements here or there. That National Security State, its function is to make the world safe for the Fortune 500 and for the people in Group A. And the history, and this is why the history of U.S. foreign policy, especially after World War II, is a history of bloody, repressive interventions on behalf of the people of Group A. U.S. leaders profess a dedication to democracy, yet over the last 50 years, U.S. National Security State, the U.S. National Security State has been a key force in overthrowing reformist democratic governments in Guatemala, Guyana, Dominican Republic, Brazil, Chile under Allende, Iran under Mossadegh, Uruguay, Syria, Indonesia under Sukarno, Greece, twice in Greece, Argentina, twice, Haiti, Bolivia, and other countries. These lists, I'm going to give you some lists, they are far from complete. And they replaced them with pro-capitalist military regimes that opened up their markets, opened up their resources, opened up the labor markets to them, and said, come on in, boys, here it is, it's all yours. And if our workers get out of line, if they start organizing and all, we can beat them down. We have death squads trained, equipped, paid for. We have a Guardia Civile, military trained, equipped for, advised by your people. All you do is take care of me, my brother Jose, my family, a few other people, and the little five or six families that own most of the land, and we'll take care of everything else for you. There's no occupational safety to worry about. There's no minimum wage to worry about. There's no environmental protections to worry about. There's no labor collective bargaining protections to worry about. There's no consumer protections. There's no child labor laws. You just come on in here. It's the free market in the free world. And that's what we're all about. And you tell your people, too, at home, that you're defending democracy, that you're having, you're bringing elections to this country and the like. But you don't talk about this part of it. The U.S. has also been active in covert actions or proxy mercenary wars against popular revolutionary governments in Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Portugal, South Yemen, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, and elsewhere. They've been active in forcibly overthrowing reformist governments in Egypt, Lebanon, Peru, Iran, Syria, Zaire, Jamaica, the Fiji Islands, Afghanistan. Before the Soviets ever went into Afghanistan, the CIA was in there through the Pakistanis, ready to destabilize the country. Since World War II, U.S. direct military invasions, now not proxy wars, not subversion, not CIA destabilization and terror and death squads, but direct military invasion with U.S. forces since World War II, or aerial attacks by U.S. forces in Vietnam, Dominican Republic, North Korea, Laos, Cambodia, Lebanon, Libya, Grenada, Panama, Iraq, Somalia, and now Yugoslavia. When you ask, why is U.S. in Yugoslavia? Why not? They're everywhere else. It's an empire, my friends. It's an empire. And the empire extracts the resources of the republic in order to maintain its imperialist network. It's an empire with 300 major military bases and 2,000 minor bases all over the world. That's a matter of public record. I'm not just arguing that point. It's a matter of public record. Not that it's much taught and rarely ever mentioned in the mainstream media. Now, why has a professedly peace-loving democratic nation found it necessary to use so much violence and repression against so many peoples in so many places? An important goal, as I say, is to make the world safe for the Fortune 500. Governments that strive for any kind of economic independence, governments that support any kind of populist redistributive politics, which is extracting, say, as Allende did in Chile. In the 3 years he was in office, he took a portion of the gross national income, maybe about 5 or 6 or 7%, shifted from the people in Group A, the people who lived off their investments, to the people who lived off their labor. And that was what was wrong with Allende. When you come in and you start taking and tampering with my wealth, I will kill you. And that's what they did to Allende. Such governments are the ones most likely to feel the wrath of U.S. intervention or invasion. The designated enemy can be a reformist, populist military government, as in Panama under Torrijos, and even under Noriega, Egypt under President Nasser, Peru under Velasco, Portugal after Salazar, when the generals came in. It could be a Christian socialist government, as in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas. It could be a social democracy popular front, as in Chile under Allende, or in Jamaica under Michael Manley, or in Greece under Papandreou in 1965, or the Dominican Republic under Juan Bosch. Or it could be a Marxist-Leninist government, as in Cuba, Vietnam, North Korea. It could be an Islamic revolutionary order, as in Libya under Gaddafi, or even a conservative militarist regime, as in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein was CIA. He was put in by the CIA, and his job was to stop and put a brake on the Iraqi revolution. And he was our boy. He was the White House's boy for a long time. But then he started doing some funny things like free medical care, education. Iraq had one of the better standards of living in the entire Middle East. And then he started doing something that was totally unacceptable, trying to fight for a better deal on the oil prices against the Seven Sister oil cartels. And that's when, of course, he had to be done in. The U.S. is also the most active promoter or protector of drug traffickers who serve the gangster functions of U.S. policy, which is terror, assassination, intimidation. Late 1940s, Corsica and Sicilian drug mafia, communist longshore unions, which were honest and militant and dedicated and political, were smashed by these gangsters and terrorists with the help and aid by the CIA. And the payback that the CIA gave to these gangsters was a free hand in the drug trades. In Southeast Asia, the drug lords, active collaboration, the Golden Triangle, Air America was the airline that shipped the heroin out of there. Air America, it turned out, was owned by the CIA. And do you know what the first market was for the Golden Triangle? Where was it? That's right. The soldiers in Vietnam, a perfect market. Nearby, 100,000 young men with nothing to do, homesick, with good money as compared to most of the world, spending money, nothing to do, and all of them, or so many of them, come back with a drug problem. That drug problem didn't just happen. The Vietnam GIs just didn't suddenly just go berserk. It's because that the drugs were there, they were cheap, they were plentiful, they were pouring in. Supply creates demand. We always think of demand creating supply, but in many instances, it's supply that creates demand. In Afghanistan, the Mujahideen who fought against the Soviets were drug dealers. I remember seeing it prominently displayed in the Washington Post on page 22 to 35th paragraph. With the Mujahideen back in power, the heroin supplies, much of which reaches the American streets, will now increase in abundance. I said, isn't this amazing? It's like it was a weather report. There was this one sentence in the middle. I said, now can you imagine if that was Fidel Castro or the Sandinistas or somebody? Why, they'd still be talking about it on the evening news 3 years later, referencing it. And they were CIA supported. And now we have the Kosovar Albanians. Let me quote the San Francisco Chronicle, 5 May, 99. Kosovar Albanians, including the KLA, hold the largest share of the heroin market in Switzerland, Austria, Belgium, Germany, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Norway, and Sweden. The eminent political scientist Jim Petras told me just the other day that the KLA leader owns the biggest whorehouse in Europe. It's in Macedonia. The poverty that we see throughout the Third World, those people struggling in Group B, many of them falling into Group C, the hundreds of millions of them, that poverty is not an original historical condition. It was imposed by colonizing forces. Walter Rodney, who was assassinated, Walter Rodney wrote an interesting book called How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And I always thought the title, the use of the word underdeveloped as a verb, was very important and very revealing. That it was something that was done to Africa. Africa wasn't underdeveloped. There were rich cultures there. Africa is a rich continent. Latin America is a rich continent. Asia is a rich continent. The imperialists, the colonialists, don't go to poor places. They go to rich places. They go in there to take their markets, to take their oil, their timber, their cotton, their hemp, their flax, their gold, their silver, their diamonds, and a thousand other things. And they go in there to exploit and ruthlessly exploit their labor. That's why I go, Africa is rich, only its people are poor. And there are still problems in Africa today. There are still outrageous things going on in Africa. Building their own pharmaceutical factories in the Sudan. Where do you get off thinking you can do that when you should be buying pharmaceuticals from the multinational pharmaceuticals? Owning your own land. A lot of the land in Africa is still in the village economy. collectively run, often, by the way, run and worked by women in collectives. They got no business running that land. That's our land. That's our land. That belongs to us. The agribusiness multinationals will get that land. That's what Clinton was doing in Africa last year. He was letting them know there's going to be a GAT for Africa. A GAT, when I was a kid in the old gangster movies, a GAT was a gun you held to somebody's head. Indeed. It's getting worked up here. So the goal is to deracinate the population, that is, get them off the land, de-skill them, and then force them to work at subsistence wages. Take the case of India. India was a rich, advanced, developed country until the British went in 1800. And between 1800 and 1830, the Indian textile industry, which was outperforming the British textile industry in exports and quality, was dismantled. And between 1840, and the whole balance of trade was shifted, the great textile centers of Dhaka and Madras were deindustrialized, and the people were sent back out on the land to grow cotton for the factories in Manchester and London. And between 1850 and 1900, the Indian per capita income fell by 65%. So that poverty in the third world, that so-called underdevelopment, these so-called developing nations that are now beginning, like little children learning how to walk, and we will help them along. These countries are not underdeveloped. They were overexploited. They're maldeveloped. And it's not racism that sends the white colonizers off into Latin America, Africa, and Asia. They don't care what color you are. Imperialism is an equal opportunity exploiter. The first imperialism was by Western Europe against Eastern Europe, against the Slavs, back in the 1500s and 1600s. They were whites. The oldest imperialism of the British colony is against Ireland. Frederick Engels, traveling through Ireland in 1856. How often have the Irish started out to achieve something, and every time they have been crushed politically and industrially? By consistent oppression, they have been artificially converted into an utterly impoverished nation. There's the key words, artificially converted into an impoverished nation. Of course, when you start finding out that so many of the people that you are oppressing and killing are colored, that comes in handy, you see. You can start saying things like, well, they're moral inferiors. These darker races are savages and such. After you go in and you burn their townships and their homes and destroy their smelting, construction, their industry. They have some industry, mining even, and whatever else. You kill their men or enslave them for your work in your industry. You do all this kind of stuff. You have to justify that, and you say, this is the white man's burden. We're here to try to help these people, to uplift them, you see. Always beware of the people who are ready to uplift you. And so that's, and racism, in short order, racism becomes a very useful thing to cloak and justify class exploitation. Now, why is the U.S. national security state involved in acts of destabilization, sabotage, propaganda, terror, drug trafficking, torture, and death squads in Latin America, Asia, Africa, and Europe? Why is it now suddenly so impelled by humanitarian concerns for the Albanians in Kosovo? Is that why we're in Yugoslavia? Is it humanitarian compassion that compels U.S. forces to be bombing, to have bombed four countries in the last 6 months? Is it humanitarian concern that the U.S. is involved in proxy wars in Angola, Colombia, and various other countries? If it's oppressed minorities U.S. leaders are worried about, why doesn't Clinton bomb the Turkish people for what their leaders have been doing to the Kurds? Why doesn't he? I mean, it would be crazy and irrational to bomb people in Turkey, to bomb the ordinary people because of what they're doing. But that's what we're doing. That's what is happening in Yugoslavia. Why don't we bomb the Indonesians for killing over 200, because their generals killed over 200,000 East Timorese? What about bombing Israel for what it's done to the Palestinians? What about bombing the Czech Republic for the way it has mistreated the Romani, or called gypsies here in our country? What about bombing the Guatemalan people? Let's go bomb Guatemala City for the systematic slaughter of tens of thousands of Mayan villagers all over Guatemala. In fact, the U.S. wouldn't ever think of bombing them. The U.S., in most of those cases, Turkey, Indonesia, Guatemala, gave them aid, gave them guns, gave them training, is totally complicit with those horrible atrocities. Why doesn't he bomb Great Britain for oppressing the Catholic minority in Northern Ireland? Go bomb his girlfriend, Tony Blair. Tony Blair is Bill Clinton in drag. Look closely at him. Why doesn't he bomb the Hutu for the mass murder of 500,000 Tutsis in Rwanda and bomb the French imperialist force that went in and was totally complicit in that massacre? In fact, Bill Clinton didn't even want to discuss it. He didn't even want to apply the name genocide to that. He didn't want to get into it because he liked the stopping of the Tutsi Liberation Army. They had a scent of Columbia about them. And while Clinton is at it, why doesn't he bomb himself for the treatment of Native American Indians, African Americans, and working people in general? In 1919, a noted conservative economist, Joseph Schumpeter, whose work I've read extensively, incidentally, Schumpeter wrote this about ancient Rome. Excuse me. That policy which pretends to aspire to peace but unerringly generates war, the policy of continual preparation for war, the policy of meddlesome interventionism. There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were those of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, then allies would be invented. When it was utterly impossible to contrive such an interest, why then it was the national honor that had been insulted. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, always fighting for a breathing space. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their indubitably aggressive designs. They were enemies who only waited to fall on the Roman people. Does that sound familiar to you at all? We hear today that we don't have one enemy. We have many now. The world communism has been defeated, but now we have many different enemies. They're all around, ready to pounce on us. And unless we keep those extortionary military budgets going, unless we keep being everywhere, all the place, our people will not be safe. They're out there ready to pounce upon us. Why aren't they ready to pounce upon Denmark, say? Why doesn't Denmark have a world empire? What about little, weak, helpless, sweet Luxembourg? Wouldn't they want to pounce on Luxembourg? Why would they want to pounce on us? Well, I maintain that that's just the mass line to cover the class line. I gave you what the class line was a little while ago. Yugoslavia, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, was built on an idea, as Ramsey Clark said. Very few countries are actually built on an idea. The idea was that the southern Slavs would not remain weak, divided people falling out among themselves or falling prey to some imperialist outsider. That they would join together and they would have a territory that was large enough and strong enough to become a viable nation with its own development. And sure enough, after World War II, multi-ethnic, socialist Yugoslavia was a post-war industrial power, a viable nation, and an economic success. Between 1960 and 1980, it had one of the most vigorous growth rates, a decent standard of living, free medical care and education, guaranteed right to a job, 1 month free vacation with pay. Oh, when was the last time I had a month vacation? Oh, I can't remember. Affordable public transportation, housing, and utilities. Literacy rate, over 90%. Life expectancy was 72 years. Most of the economy was in the public, not-for-profit sector. Now, such a country is a kind that global capitalism normally would not tolerate. Still, Yugoslavia was allowed to exist for some 45 years because it was seen as a buffer to the Soviet bloc, the Warsaw Pact nations. At the same time, efforts were made to undermine the socialistic features of Yugoslavia's economy. Yugoslavia opened itself up to Western capital penetration as early as the late 60s, early 70s, I think it was. I think they made the same mistake that the Polish Communist Party leaders made. They said, well, what we're going to do is continual basic industry, building up the industrial base, heavy industry, and we're also going to increase and improve consumer production. Now, how are we ever going to be able to do both of those things, you see? Very simply, we got the answer. We'll borrow from the West. Well, once they started borrowing, with borrowing from the West came IMF penetration and an enormous debt. With debt came IMF demands for restructuring. Restructuring is a euphemism for a harsh austerity program. You cut back in public sector spending. You cut wages. You cut employment. You abolish worker management enterprises. In other words, you force your people to work harder for less, producing more, consuming less, and with that difference, you pay off your debt schedule, or at least the interest that's accumulating on this wealth. Still, much of the economy was public sector and not for profit, including the very rich reserves of minerals and other natural resources in the province of Kosovo and elsewhere. Then came another blow. What I'm saying to you is that there was a conscious and deliberate plan to fragment and break up Yugoslavia. The other blow was in November of 1990, when President George Bush went to the U.S. Congress and pressured them to pass the Foreign Appropriations Law that called for the cutting off of all aid and credits to Yugoslavia. Trading without credits can be a disaster, especially for a country that doesn't have a hard currency. And this had a devastating effect on the country. The law also demanded that if any republic in Yugoslavia wanted further U.S. aid, it would have to break away from Yugoslavia and declare its independence. Okay, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's not my speculation. It's not my analysis. It's a public law. It's a public law. November 1990, the 1991 Foreign Appropriations Act. It's written right there. Go look at it. It required the U.S. State Department approval of election procedures and results in every one of the republics. It required that the republics do not hold national elections, but hold elections only in their own republics, and that the aid would go to individually to those republics. And when the aid did go, it went to those groups which the U.S. defined as democratic groups, which meant small right-wing ultra-nationalists and even fascistic parties. The ultimate goal was to break up Yugoslavia into a weak and helpless cluster of right-wing banana republics, privatized, deindustrialized. The U.S. decided to destroy, with the other Western powers decided to destroy Yugoslavia in 1989, when it became evident that it was the one country in Eastern Europe that would not voluntarily overthrow what remained of its socialist system. It was the one country that was still trying for some kind of economic independence outside of the world global free market third worldization process. They wanted a Yugoslavia whose rich natural resources would be at the disposal of multinational corporations, whose populations would work at subsistence wages, whose economy offered no competition with existing capitalist producers, only new investment opportunities. They wanted a Yugoslavia whose petroleum, engineering, mining, and automotive industries would be undone and deindustrialized. And they wanted to abolish Yugoslavia's public sector services and social programs. Now, why would U.S. policymakers, you really think U.S. policymakers are motivated by some need to abolish the social programs, the public sector services, and Yugoslavia? Why would they want to do that? Do you think they are such nefarious, evil-intended individuals they would want to abolish their social programs? Come on, Parenti. Are you being paranoid? Well, why would they want to abolish our social programs? As they have been doing? Aid to families with dependent children, privatizing Social Security. That's what that president in Washington is doing. At least a third of it, he's going to chunk it off and privatize it. Right under your noses while saying he's saving and serving Social Security, public health services, public education, environmental regulation, as inadequate at all as all of these things have been, being cut back, cut back, cut back, library services. Oh, we used to have that service. Sorry, we don't have enough funds anymore. Not enough funds because we've got to build those missiles, you see. It's the third worldization of Yugoslavia, and it's the third worldization of the USA, and it's the third worldizations of everywhere. That's what the people in column A want. They want a nation that's run by about 50 multi-billionaires, and the rest of us will be 260 million peasants working from hand to mouth for them. Another goal behind the dismemberment of Yugoslavia is to achieve ideological monopoly. Last year, in Serbian Bosnia, the last remaining radio station was a Serbian station. It was a dissident station. It was critical of NATO, critical of Western policy. It was the last station in all of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And the article in the New York Times, to see the reporter committing these mental gymnastics to explain why the NATO peacekeepers, i.e. Gestapo troops, went in and closed the station down, why that was a step toward more pluralistic democracy. That this was it was a marvelous thing to watch him do these gyrations, you know, down this column. Yugoslavia, before the NATO bombings, before this war began, before that, in Yugoslavia, every opposition newspaper, every opposition political party had its own newspaper, its own radio station, and there were over 20 of them. Milosevic today has more opposition parties in his parliament than any other leader in Europe. Of course, since the NATO bombings, they've shut down all the newspapers, they've shut down their radio stations, as we had happen in this country with German stations and things like that in World War I, if you remember, and we weren't even being bombed or attacked. Milosevic has been elected president three times, twice of the Republic of Serbia, once of the Yugoslav Republic, or what's left of it now, in elections which foreign observers said were pretty much okay and legitimate. Yet he is called a dictator. He is called a war criminal. The Hague War Crimes Tribunal has asked the United States for documentation of the war crimes that he has committed so that they may indict him as a war criminal. So far, it's been over a year. No documentation has been forthcoming. Will you please tell me, Noam Chomsky called him the monstrous Milosevic, giving no specifics. Could someone start giving me some specifics about it? Yugoslavia has another problem on this ideological monopoly. Its TV station is state-owned and is run by people who do not see the world the way the U.S. State Department and the U.S. National Security State does. The Yugoslav TV journalist Novenka Jovicic told me, if I pronounce her last name right, I remember, she told me when I met her in Greece, this was at a conference, she told me that she asked the U.S. ambassador, "What do you want from us?" This was last year before the bombings. And he said, "We want your television system. Give us that." The U.S. imperialists want an ideological monopoly of all the world's media. And they've got something close to that already. In 1992, another blow was delivered against what remained of Yugoslavia. International sanctions led by the U.S. A freeze was imposed on all trade with Yugoslavia. The results brought utter economic disaster, hyperinflation, mass unemployment up to 70%, malnourishment, the collapse of the healthcare system at great cost to the population. By the way, sanctions, as the sanctions in Iraq demonstrate so horribly, the civilian population does not suffer collateral damage or incidental spin-off from sanctions. The civilian population is the primary target of sanctions. That's who's being targeted. To justify this violent intervention to the U.S. public, there's been an unrelenting demonization of the Serbian people for the better part of a decade. Don't take my word for it. Listen to Charles Boyd. Listen to his credentials. Former deputy commander of the U.S. European Command. Listen to where he wrote in Foreign Affairs, the establishment journal, the establishment foreign policy journal in the U.S. In Foreign Affairs, September, October 94, Boyd says, "The popular image of this war in Bosnia is one of unrelenting Serbian expansion. In fact, what the Croatians call the occupied territories is land which the Serbs have held for more than three centuries. Most of the same is true of Serb land in Bosnia." In short, the Serbs are trying to hold on to their own. "The U.S. has punished one side in this war, and unfairly," Boyd says. "It has supported the legitimacy of a leadership in the Bosnian Muslim government that has become increasingly ethnocentric in its makeup, single party in its rule, and manipulative in its diplomacy. We say we want peace, but we have encouraged a deepening of the war." Why were the Serbs targeted for demonization? By the way, at first they weren't. The U.S. was sort of backing the Serbs, and they got a guy, they pulled a guy up who they decided would be their man in the breaking up of Yugoslavia. He was a banker, and he was a Serbian nationalist, and his commitment to communism was very, very fuzzy or vague. And he was the ideal guy, they thought, and they called him a charismatic personality. His name was Milosevic. And he was our guy. But when they discovered that instead of being a tool, he would be an obstacle, then, of course, he became demonized. The Serbs are the largest nationality, and they're the one most opposed to the breakup of the Federation. But what about all the atrocities they've committed? Well, atrocities and executions have been committed on all three sides. You know, it really was fascinating. Someone got to do a media analysis of this. In 95, when Clinton was thinking of going in to Bosnia, the atrocity stories about the Serbs started piping up. I'll talk about some of them later in a minute. When he decided, as the 96 election started getting closer, when he decided it might be too messy and we shouldn't go in, the atrocity stories slowed down, and then the media started. There was a frame of about a month or a couple of months there, a frame where they started saying, the Serbs are not the only ones committing atrocities, and they started quoting Croatian and Muslim atrocities and this sort of thing. It was amazing. Then when he decided after 96 that he was going to go in again, then the Serb atrocity stories came up again. It's sort of like the gas flame on your stove, the way the media will follow policy. And there's no hidden mystery about it. There's no conspiracy about it. They wait to what's fed out to them. If the Pentagon or the U.S. or the White House says, this is terrible, this is terrible. We've got to go do this. They've got to go do this. U.S. are concerned. We've got to go do that. They are the